Welcome to the Minarda Garden Podcast. Hi, I'm Adam Gariak, and this was where we discuss topics within the intersection of food, nature, and land management. I think you're going to love this podcast episode with Dr. Brett Lenner, because Brett is a deep thinker, a soft-spoken gentleman, and he's somebody whose thoughts may not always reach the radio wave, but when you stop to listen, you realize the extent of the value that he brings to the table. Here, in this episode, we discuss the relationship between humans and the earth, and we also discuss our food systems and how they can be optimized for love. This episode is entitled Healing Our Relationship with the Land with Food Forests. I hope you enjoy it. And we're live! I'm sitting here with the man, the legend, Brett Lenner.
Correct.
You're Dr. Brett Lenner now.
Dr. Brett.
Wow. And why we brought Brett here today is because Brett also has been working on his half-acre food forest for the past 7 or so years.
Yeah.
And there's been such tremendous growth. And I see so much good in this food forest when I stroll it, but I don't want to get too far into it. Welcome, Brett, to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Adam. Thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So, start off with the food forest. First, maybe, what is a food forest?
Well, you know, some people would say that every forest is a food forest, and, you know, whenever you walk through the woods, there's always, you know, certain things that you can appreciate and certain nutritious qualities or, you know, medicinal qualities about many plants that you come across. But a food forest, as the term is typically used these days, generally relates to a collection of plants that are designed typically in often a seven layers largely of size that when put together mimic and then begin to interact like an actual forest, having canopy layer of trees, an understory layer, having bushes and shrubs, having perennial vegetables, herbaceous plants, having, you know, smaller grasses, having tuberous root type crops, and then having vining plants as well. With the intention that all of those plants are designed either to produce food themselves or to support the other plants within that forest ecosystem.
Wow, that's beautiful. So, what has been your history with the food forest? Maybe tell us a little bit about how it began for you.
Well, when I was first introduced to the concept, it was a very eureka moment. I do remember being in the library at college and stumbling across a video of Eric Tonesmeyer first describing the concept, and just being so filled with excitement that I got up out of my seat and left and walked around, and I walked around to the this local hill, Horse Barn Hill, and I just remember imagining the forests around there as if they were designed with that purpose, you know, designed with large canopy nut-producing trees, larger, smaller fruit trees underneath them, and just the whole vision just clicked in like a single moment for me as like just a really powerful way of interacting with the world. And since then, I've been engrossed by that idea and just been taken by that concept.
So the excitement that you felt was derived from this vision that this new vision for a way, as you say, for humans to interact with the world.
Yeah, and I would say that excitement was preceded by I don't know if I want to say a sense of desperation or a sense of the troubles that the state the world was in.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there's two forms of motivation that are out there. There's desperation and inspiration. There was a study with, Jordan Peterson talks about this. There was a study with starving rats, and they had this smell of cheese in front of them, and they were starving, they were hungry, and they were on a sort of that wheel, and they were measuring how fast that they were trying to go towards that cheese. So this would be a measure of desire and inspiration, if you will. They're inspired to go get that cheese because they're hungry. They measured the speed, the rate, and they correlated that with the inner drive. And then they also measured it with this same cheese smell, but then also the smell of a cat behind it. And the mouse went a lot faster. And so the combination of the desperation with the inspiration for the mouse propelled it forward even faster.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. So it's like, I hear the desperation, and then I observe that provoked you into such immense action over time, and I can appreciate that.
Well, and then along those lines, if I can share, then if that was the moment of inspiration, the previous moment of desperation that really stands out in my mind was back actually in 2010. And I was studying abroad at the time, and I was working with I was volunteering with a refugee agency in South Africa, and it was right before the World Cup had started there, and they had built all these temporary shelters in like this really dry, deserty terrain outside of the town, and these were corrugated tin shacks. There was just, you know, electrical wires running over the top. There's sun beating down on these, you know, bright, shiny tin houses on a sandy land. And you walked inside the houses, they were beating hot, and they housed refugees from different parts of Africa, people who had been displaced by political disruption as well as climate disruption that was beginning at that time. And interacting in that space, I was also struck by like a sense that was one possible future for the world, and that just this really primal desperate need for green things, and how the relationship between the lack of green things and the lack of life and then people who were displaced and essentially, you know, they could have might as well have been in the colony on the moon at that point. Mm. It was so barren.
Wow. And that reminds me, so we're coming at you from the temperate deciduous forests in southwestern Connecticut, generally. The watershed that we're at is the Housatonic Valley watershed, about 400 feet above sea level. And currently coming at you from some lowlands. We're basically in a converted swamp here with a couple ponds nearby. And this landscape, I mention this because it does typify, in my mind, abundance to an extent. Wherever there's a wild patch that isn't maintained, nature is doing its thing. You know, there's like lush grass will begin to grow. You know, trees are deep, lush green with their leaves. And we're right near a bunch of wild land where we have one of the most beautiful streams I've ever laid my eyes upon, along with many wild fields, wildflower meadows that are being maintained as such. And so, to an extent, it seems to me, especially when I hear your story, that we live in a freaking paradise, you know, but that doesn't necessarily mean that. I think that the food forests are such a so needed right now for so many reasons that, yes, they do need it over there in that scenario that you're talking about, and that would solve many problems, both logistical, like food, like shade, but then also it would solve problems like spiritual, like emotional, like the world, our inner world, is a mirror reflection of our outer world. And when we step outside and we see this barren landscape with these shanties and everything, it reaffirms a negative inner state. And so if there was a state of abundance there with these food forests, with trees, with shrubs, with grasses, and, you know, ripe fruit hanging from the vine, then that would reaffirm abundance within for these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. And, the interesting thing about the environment that we live in is that while it is so lush with life itself, it's also so misunderstood, and there's such a great degree of illiteracy of the actual goings on of all of this growth. And in that sense, while it's so abundant, it's also incredibly underutilized and to a degree unruly and wild, in a sense that it's misunderstood. And if we better knew how to integrate our own lives into it, and were able to see that reflection, like you talk about, understand how our humanity mirrors the life around us, then we wouldn't rely on, if we were able to fulfill more of our resources via these local relationships, we wouldn't rely on, you know, foreign labor exploitation. We wouldn't rely on these systems of global capital that create those systems which create refugees. So not only would it be good for them in that sense, but also in the sense that we, you know, even though we live in such a lush place, we outsource so much and we so underutilize the potential of this landscape to, to meet our physical needs and then also our spiritual and emotional needs if we were to build those local connections and relationships.
Mm. Yeah, it seems like you're right that the goal of efficiency in this global system that we find ourselves in has weeded out community-based and local, let's say, public food gathering or these relationships. And I appreciate what you said about how it's misunderstood, because it reminds me of a story of my great uncle. Now I come from hillbillies, and these hillbillies didn't have much money, but they had, you know, the can-do attitude and, you know, a lot of good common sense, but rough around the edges for sure. Now my great uncle Norm, who I didn't know too well, so I only really know him from his stories, from his son, which is my second cousin. So he talks about his father, Great Uncle Norm, about how when Great Uncle Norm was growing up, he was poor. He was poorer than poor. Had no money. And, what did you do when you were poor back then? Let's say this was, the 1940s or so, 50s. There were no McDonald's dollar menus, you know. There wasn't, like, the food at the grocery store wasn't this cheap. So what he did was he foraged and he hunted for his food. And so he knew where every best mushroom patch was in town. He knew where every last nut tree was to gather the hickory nuts to consume. He knew, you know, and so nuts and mushrooms and herbs and perennial vegetables, and then also animals, whether it's deer or even squirrel. But what does this imply? It wasn't just some dude like exploiting nature. You have to tap into nature and understand nature in order to know where these patches are going to be. You have to know where the wet spots are. You have to know where the ridge tops, the valleys. You have to know where's the eastern facing slope, the western facing slope, and then all of these different attributes create a character in the landscape. And people who subsisted off of the land, at least even if it's just to an extent, they tap into that, and so they develop that understanding. And so,
yeah, I agree, and I think a lot of, you know, the rural poor have been misunderstood in that regard, so that they're commonly considered uneducated and illiterate, but they tend to have a vast ecological knowledge that maybe certain city folks just didn't quite grow up with. And then a couple things actually that you said make me think. One thing is that I've heard that back in the 1920s, around the time of the Great Depression, one of the things that really did kind of put a nail in the coffin of people living the poor in Kentucky and Appalachia was the loss of the American chestnut tree around that time.
Hmm.
And the fact that they could no longer, one, forage for chestnuts in the fall, and then also they weren't able to run their livestock through the forest at that time too. That really put a damper on their local economies in a way that they really did lean into the forests when they didn't have the larger capital from banks and other institutions at the time.
Hmm.
And then the other point that I think this kind of taps into a little bit is just going back to that overarching theme of relationships and a healthy relationship with the natural world, in that the modern, I want to say, Western colonial approach to the natural world, you know, going back to John Muir, when in Yosemite the indigenous people were kicked off the land in order to create that national park, it's been a relationship of unattachment, a relationship not of reciprocity with the land, but a relationship of, you know, look at this thing, put it separate, put it in a museum behind glass, and maybe we, you know, worship it, but we don't know it. We don't live with it. It's not our brother. It's not our sister. It's not our family. And so even now, re-entering the natural world back into our family, you know, with that reciprocity of, I give something to you, you give something to me. I may eat the chestnuts that fall from the tree, and then I will plant them in turn to further the forest for future generations. That may be the evolution of the conservation movement, and also just our way to reintegrate just the world, the natural world around us, and ourselves as humans, to enter back into the natural world as the animals that we are.
Yeah. So that relationship right now, what we're seeing in the conservation world of hands off, of leave no trace, of, look but don't touch, do not tap on the glass, it is, I can see where it came from. And, you know, they want, even the word conservation, what does it imply? Like, we want to you know, conserve this thing, or preservation, want to preserve this thing. When you preserve something, you freeze it, you know, and you're not, there's no interaction with it. And so even the words that we use for ecological, like, healing, are baked in the ideology of, you know, the popular mode of interaction, which is a lack of interaction. And yeah, whether you just talk about the natives, and then I'm also seeing the similarities with the rural poor you're talking about in the 1920s, and how they also lived off the land. And for them, I'm sure there was similar circumstances at times when, I mean, whether it's, I mean, the chestnut blight is one thing, but then I'm also sure that they were told at certain points, oh, you can't, you know, you can't harvest here, you can't be here, this isn't your property, or things like this. And now, over the past 100 years, it's just become more and more and more prevalent. And so, with the food forests that we're creating, it's there's a lot of reasons that we want to do it. But it seems like, almost seems like the primary reason is because of this type of psychological, not attachment, but a psychological, like, modality, or this way we've been thinking about the landscape, that really it feels like it needs to change. And do you agree with that?
I agree with that. And I would say that, you know, even I myself, when I first started to learn about things like permaculture, I would ask the questions of, like, well, how does an acre of corn compare to an acre of forest garden? How many calories can we get from each? And really, you know, just focus on questions that, once you get into it further, you just see more and more how they're just entirely irrelevant questions.
Yeah.
In the same way that you wouldn't look at your child and be like, well, what is my child, how much money are they going to make for me? That would sound like an absurd question. Once you start building these relationships with the natural world, their inherent value, the value of the trees that you plant from seed, you wait 6 years and then you taste a fruit for the first time from them, and they're a totally unique being in the world that you can then, you know, start the seeds from that fruit, and another 6 years down the line, once you start building those relationships, the inherent worth of them becomes apparent, not just for your own self, but for the plants themselves, and creating diverse populations of, you know, wild American plums, of local blueberries, of seeing each species as their own community within the larger community.
Yeah. It seems like it's changing the relationship from a transactional nature of the landscape. When you mention the calories of one versus the other, it's very transactional. It's what, you know, what can you do for me?
Yeah.
You know, and that, and we're changing that into not just like from transactional to relational, but also from transactional into love.
Into love. Yeah, and all the needs still do get met at the end of the day. And
yeah,
I think it creates a better balance once the landscape fills out and expresses its health in that manner of all these diverse populations, then the role of humans can balance itself within that and be like, okay, this is the carrying capacity of a piece of land, or this is like this is the way that humans ought to relate to this environment that is, has this wholeness to it.
If you don't mind, I'm going to take a break. And we're back. So, so we've talked about the relational versus transactional way of looking at the landscape, and how transitioning towards that relational way can benefit people and the earth through, you know, basically living in this reciprocity, love-based way with the earth. And I think for me, the inspirational groundwork is laid for me to want to dive into your food forest. So I'm curious about, say things like, what are your goals with your food forest? Maybe we could start there.
The goals? Sure. And then maybe I could just start even with a little bit of how it came to be.
Great.
So the land itself, my grandparents had moved there in the 1950s. And my grandfather had come from Switzerland, my grandmother came from Mexico, and they had purchased a piece of land from their uncle, from my grandpa's uncle who had owned it before. And then my father grew up on that land, and at the time that he was growing up, it was a field. And then one year, the farmer who mowed it, Frank Frank, got sick, and he wasn't able to mow the field that year. And it grew up in, you know, little sprouting trees. And a year or two later, when he came back to mow it again, it was too tall to mow. And so it turned into a forest. And then for the next 30 years, it turned into this, early succession forest of a lot of black birch trees, autumn olives, multifloral rose, a typical early succession type old field, young forest habitat that emerges with the transition of farmland in this area. And then I grew up there myself as well. And when I graduated college, I approached my grandparents to turn that half an acre of that land into a forest garden. And so I actually started by removing a lot of the trees. I pulled out the barberry, I pulled out the autumn olive, most of them. I left some of them. I pulled out I cut down a lot of the black birch and essentially opened up a clearing in that forest, which I then was able to introduce a wide variety of species into. Pawpaws, hazelnuts, wild plums, apples, pears, peaches, blueberries, as well as smaller, herbaceous plants. Things like anise, hyssop, small shrubs like gooseberries, and then vining plants like kiwis, as well as groundnuts as well. And it became a real tangled mess there for a while. And then I consulted my good friend Adam at one point, and he said,
"You're welcome."
That as something along the lines of, balancing structure with the inherent beauty of the chaos of it. And while previously I had shunned rose, I then reoriented my trees, at least, to have rows with intermittent paths that could be easily mowed to provide access to the whole space. And since then, it's really found a nice balance between wide diversity of plants and a degree of maintainable structure that makes it inhabitable as well, and not just a total thicket.
Great. So that's where you are now. That's where you started. And it seems like the plants that you've added, it seems like most of the plants that you're adding are that shrub and small tree, and then even medium tree layer. But it does seem like there is that diversity so that you can still have the entire thing working together. Is there a reason that you seem to focus on one particular layer? And by layer, what I mean is that, like the seven layers of the forest garden, what you described early on, with the large trees is one layer, the sub canopy is a second layer, and then after that is the shrub layer is the third, right? And then the fourth would be like tall herbaceous, and the fifth is ground cover herbaceous, and then the sixth is underground, and the seventh is vining. And so out of those, you seem to have vining and then a few upright herbaceous, but mostly shrubs and small trees.
Yeah.
It seems like the shrubs and small trees is where you're at. Is there a reason that you're there primarily?
I think the reason why it tended towards that way was, you know, I initially planted a whole bunch of different layers, and those were the ones that kind of survived the best. You know, I think that the forest garden concept, you know, it did originate in the tropics, and, you know, it's an abstract concept that then gets, you know, experimented with in kind of real life, and finding the balance between maintenance of a space and this sort of to some degree like esoteric like concept of what a perfect ecosystem would be. I think like reality, just the reality of the amount of maintenance that I was able to provide to that space kind of lended itself towards that balance, really.
Right. So it seems like you had a certain amount of time that you can give to it, and so there was like one condition of the space was like number of hours per week or per month, and this ebbs and flows and changes over time, and so that was a limiting factor for your space, and it probably would be for just about anybody. Nobody's going to have unlimited time for a space.
Yeah.
And it seems like these are the plants that both survived, so, you know, they're right plant, right place, good for the climate, and then also the microclimate and the specific habitat of it. But then, not just the land, but then also the people. So the food forest as a manifestation of, you know, the peak of the triangle, and the two sides of the base of the triangle are the, you know, the inherent land, and then the people power and the conditions around those two.
Yeah, and I think that brings up a good point, because in the aspect of relationship with the land, I'm very conscious also of when I'm interacting with that space and when it feels enjoyable and when it feels like work. And I think in terms of, you know, building all these relationships on the whole, you have to have that self-reflection of, am I pushing myself beyond a comfortable balance with myself? And I don't think it's necessary to do that to have a productive, healthy, beautiful forest garden space like that. And these days, I interact with it more because it brings me joy than because I feel a sense of duty or obligation to put in a certain number of hours working on it.
Nice. So it's fun.
It's fun. To me, it has a very much just really embodies that sense of home.
Home.
In an outdoor space, which is interesting. You know, I think often we feel that sense of home when we're in our houses, but to be able to feel at home in an outdoor garden is a very unique feeling.
Yeah, that reminds me of in my work, I'm a landscaper, I'm a landscape designer, and I aim many times in my designs to create that sense of home to people in their outdoor spaces. You know, you're creating feelings, and some people want one feeling versus another, but very often they want to feel at home outside. And so creating that with the landscape, you know, putting rocks in a certain orientation or putting plants in a certain way, can provoke that feeling to an extent. But I think that there, you know, if you have, going back to the relational and the love-based way of interacting with the land, you know, if you don't have the interaction. Like if these clients of mine, if they aren't out there watering their plants and loving their plants as they're watering their plants and giving it to them, if it's all on drip irrigation and the gardener comes to fertilize and they're not giving anything to the garden and they're only a recipient, then my assumption is that they might not get the same richness in the idea of home, that in the feeling of home that they're getting. And, mm-hmm. and my assumption would be that the feeling that you're receiving from that land, in relationship with that land, is it has some depth to it.
Yeah. And to build off that, you know, if as a culture we were to move more towards a relational interaction with our local forests, with our community spaces, it would rely on that too. It's not just a matter of what rights do I have to take things from the land, but then also what responsibilities do I have that balance that that right. So do I, you know, if I'm similar to before, you know, if I'm picking, you know, fruits from a tree, then do I also take on that responsibility of planting seeds of that tree, or of clearing around it to allow it more sun? You know, if bittersweet is growing up it, to pull down the bittersweet vines so it doesn't get choked out. Things like that.
Yeah, and it seems like when you talk about responsibility in this way, that it you know, because it can be a charged word, the word responsibility. And perhaps this is a sort of responsibility that is also enjoyable, that also, like, because responsibility that has love baked into it is going to bring joy to people, yeah. You know. So, you know, and everybody has their own certain tastes and sort of activities that they love doing. And so perhaps if there was a community of people that all liked doing different things, then all of those gaps would be filled for, let's say, the maintenance and the installation of a food forest. And by that, it sounds really mechanical when I say it that way, but then also I could also say in a way of, like, instead of installing a food forest, it's like you know, creating a landscape of loving reciprocity with the land, you know.
Go ahead.
I was going to move on. Are you prepared?
I was just going to say one more point. Like, a lot of this change in relationship is a mental shift of our understanding, just the way we're looking at it. And I think historically there's a lot of connotations, at least in the Western sense, a lot of connotations of forests with ideas of wilderness, with ideas of maybe like darkness or wolves, or places that, you know, you run through like Little Red Riding Hood to get you know, out on the other side from. And, you know, kind of like blowing the lid off that whole view of the forest into this, you know, more sense of Garden of Eden.
Well, so I think that they're both true, and they're not both true in all cases. You know, like you can walk into a forest and, you know, some shit went down in that forest, you know, and it just has this feeling, like this like haunted definitely. Kind of feeling, you know. And it can be the same forest where you walk less than a quarter mile away and you are feeling the magic of the forest. So I agree that perhaps, and you know the wolves of today are the ticks and the mosquitoes, you know, which is kind of hilarious because there's such like little things that are causing such a, you know, the psychological distress. But Lyme disease is no joke. But yeah, the fear of the forest is still around today and it's real. And you know, perhaps there's some ancestral sort of wounds that are still in need of being healed. And I think that, I mean, perhaps it's a question, like, could it be the case that creating these spaces and making them more publicly available helps to heal those wounds, because they get to
experience something that, you know, more closely resembles the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, I think it starts to do that for people, and it also starts to do it for all the animals too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we haven't yet talked about that point, which is that, you know, the food forest is A, healing the relationship between man and nature, and also the relationship between man and, well, humans and food, and the inner world mirrors the outer world, and so we're building ourselves up. But we haven't yet talked about the benefits to nature. Have you experienced in your 7 years in the food forest any specific sort of like a sense of ecological healing in that space?
For the small space that it is, I've seen a lot of really interesting dynamics pop up that didn't previously exist there. For one, after I did remove the barberry from that space, just, you know, anecdotally, these years I pull many fewer ticks off of me than I did when I would walk through there previously, when it was largely a overgrown young forest of barberry. Then, you know, in the past, probably about 2 years ago, there was an owl that moved in, and around the clearing where all the small shrubs and trees are, there's these really large, beautiful canopy trees, and so it's really perfect habitat for hawks and owls, who can, you know, perch up there 100 feet up, and in the tall grasses that, you know, I don't get to mowing maybe as frequently as other people would prefer, and they're like a foot tall or so. It's really just a perfect, hunting ground for these owls and hawks, which attracts them. Similarly, too, it attracts the local foxes who come, not only for the small rodents, but then in time they will also eat, you know, the fruits, the beech plums, the American plums, the other, peaches and like drupes that start to fall around the trees. There's a family of deer, four or five of them, who frequent the forest garden on a nightly basis.
Mm.
And, you know, figuring out the balance with them was interesting, because in the beginning I did put up a fence, about a 6-7 foot fence around the whole thing, and they managed to hop it. And a year or two later I took it down, and my relationship with them at this point is that if they browse too much on a young tree, I'll spray that tree with a little chili powder pepper spray, and they'll back off on that one tree. But once the trees reach a certain size, you know, they browse a little bit, but they don't do much damage. And so now that the majority of the trees are, 7-8 feet tall, I don't even have to spray anymore. And the deer, they graze on the grass around the trees, and they browse a little bit on them, but they're perfectly in balance, and they're pooping in the garden, they're offering something back in return too. So
nice. Yeah. So you have you're witnessing some, even in your little half acre plot, some real tangible benefits to the ecosystem. I feel inspired to because you mentioned barberry and there's less ticks, and there's like a stigma around barberry, right? And I don't see any plant, and we're laughing because, like, there's invasive plant people who vilify the invasive plant, when even the term invasive plant has so much emotion around it that it's not scientific. It's no longer scientific to call something invasive. That doesn't make it, because science purports to be objective, and that language is not objective. So an alternative term would be opportunistic. Find, they're usually generalists, so they can work in a wide array of environments, and then once they get into an environment, they can spread pretty easily. Now, when this happens with a plant that we like let's say it's grass, lawn grass, when we're trying to grow a lawn, no, that's not invasive because we want that there, you know. But if that same lawn grass was in a meadow, we would say, okay, now it's invasive, you know. So again, subjective. But so for the barberry, people call it an invasive plant. And people say it's evil or bad, either way, because there are more ticks around barberry plants, and so there's a correlation there. But then the question for me arises: is it causation or correlation? So how ticks get around the barberry plants is because, from my understanding, mice are actually the greatest holder of ticks, not deer, because there's, you know, so many mice out there, and the mice take shelter under the barberry. And so, you know, a fox can't get a mouse under the barberry, and an owl can't get a mouse under the barberry, and so they're protected. And so you have a lot more rodents that are able to live. And so you could call the barberry a tick harborer, but you can also call it a mouse harborer. And, you know, mice aren't that bad, you know. So to an extent, it's what you focus on. But then on top of that, in your situation, you remove the barberry, and you notice the ticks go away. But when you remove the barberry, you're also inviting the foxes to be able to consume the rodents. Mm-hmm. You're also inviting the owls to be able to see the rodents and everything.
And I do think that is a good point about the invasive plants. Because it is easy to be very black and white and say, this plant is good, this plant is bad, you know, we should totally remove this one, we should totally introduce this one. And, you know, similarly, just to the concepts of relationships in general, it's just about bringing all the plants back into relationship. So it's not that barberry is bad per se, as much as it's out of relationship with the whole. And I would say that about certain other, you know, things we deem as invasive as well, in the same way that, you know, we could say that people are out of relationship with the whole, in that there's this paradigm of health, of like this balance of it that can exist when things are in a certain relationship. And when, you know, it's not the barberry's fault that it got out of relationship. It got thrown in an environment where it was opportunistic and it benefited from that. But just from, you know, like it was introduced in the colonial period, I'm not sure exactly why, maybe as a landscaping plant, maybe as a weed.
I think likely landscaping.
And then now it's taken off like that. And, you know, and there are benefits to barberry, right? There's, you know, there's the medicinal qualities of the roots, there's the berries that are used in, you know, Middle Eastern dishes. And so it's not a... I think that's a good point. It's not a bad plant. It's not like you are bad and you know, you should be eradicated. It's more the question, I think, yeah, of how can you come back into relationship with the whole?
Yeah.
And like, how can we all come back into relationship with the whole?
Mm-hmm. And also, how does this serve the goals of my landscape?
Hmm.
You know, who knows, if you're like a rodent lover,
Maybe you're trying to raise mice for, I don't know, owl breeding or something.
Maybe you'll have a bunch of barberry, a whole field of it, you know.
If you're trying to like reintroduce the bubonic plague.
Yeah. Well, now we're back to the bad thing, but I was trying to think of some good things. Yeah, and I think that the invasive species question is an important one with the food forest specifically. Because if people have the stigma around invasive plants, and that quote unquote native plants are the only plants that you're going to install, then you're really limiting your selection, and that is, I guess that, you know, there might be a plant that's, you know, perfect for your design that, you know, like, because, let's just take autumn olive, for instance. autumn olive is, in my opinion, a great plant. I love autumn olive. And I love it because it provides food for people and for wildlife in the form of its berries, which are just delicious. But you don't pick them too early because they get astringent if they're early. They look ready, but they're not ready yet. You gotta let them sit for a bit. And then the birds love them. The deer love them. And then they're also nitrogen-fixing shrubs. Right, that's true, right? Yeah. So they take the nitrogen from the atmosphere. Well, they don't do it. They have symbiotic relationships with bacteria that are in nodules in their roots. And the bacteria take the nitrogen from the atmosphere and they, you know, they chemically change it to put it, to make it into a usable form for plants. And they exchange this nitrogen to the plant in exchange for being able to be housed in their roots. It's a mutualistic relationship. And so that's why autumn olives will typically grow in environments, in old field environments, because these environments are typically nitrogen poor. And so plants that are adapted for nitrogen poor soils tend to thrive. And so, you know, you can consider autumn olive a nasty plant, or you can consider a plant that is telling you something about the landscape. And so you can treat it as a sign. You can treat it as like information. But for me, if I'm trying to create a garden that fertilizes itself so that I don't need to spread chicken manure or plant tone or whatever every year, then I might add nitrogen fixers, and autumn olive might be one of them. And then the other thing that it does is that it has flowers in the spring, and the flowers are just loaded on the shrub. It just has hundreds and hundreds of these little flowers, and it has such a beautiful scent. The aroma can travel like many, many feet, and so it can, an entire field can be, transformed aromatically with the scent of the autumn olive. So I love the plant, but it's quote unquote invasive because it self-seeds. So might I incorporate it into a food forest one day? Maybe. You know, but I certainly wouldn't exclude it based upon this label of invasive.
Yeah, I agree. Along those lines, like when in removing them from that patch of land, I removed a lot of them, but then I left some of them, and they're growing amongst the wild plums right now. So it's some autumn olives and some wild plums growing together.
Right.
for the reasons that you mentioned. Nitrogen fixing, the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Benefits to wildlife as well.
Nice. So. And I'd also like to describe... So, I'd like to describe your ecosystem from the perspective of, like, I wouldn't call myself an ecologist but I studied ecology in school, and I find myself diving into that world on a day-to-day basis as a professional gardener, always thinking from that perspective. And so, what you did when you're transforming your forest from forest into forest garden is you're changing both how the sunlight interacts with your landscape. So that's the first thing. So the more ups and downs in your landscape, aka going from canopy all the way down to ground layer, the more you're increasing the net primary productivity, which is how much sunlight gets converted into usable energy by the plant. So you're increasing that. And then on top of that, what you're doing is when sunlight hits a tree, much of that energy that it creates goes into storage. It just goes into the structure of the tree, which is generally unusable unless you get a tree that's starting to rot or something that's diseased. But generally it's unusable. But when sunlight hits grass, that all that grass is usable by herbivores. you know, and even when you plant small trees, a relatively higher percentage is of the energy is going into fruit rather than the percentage of the energy that goes into storing energy when you storing the energy when you plant a, let's say, a large maple or something. So so you're increasing the amount of energy in the landscape that gets converted into energy every gets converted into plant matter every year, and then you're also raising the proportion of that plant matter that's being usable by both humans and wildlife, and then you're seeing this explosion of life. It's, you know, relatively small in terms of deer and owl and foxes, only a couple of each, but you're bringing the ecosystem back. And I think that the those energetic dynamics are at the foundation of it.
Yeah, and it's just a half an acre of land, and just, you know, the potential of those similar relationships to that on broader scales has a lot to offer.
Imagine.
Because as, you know, as beneficial as it is to have all this closed canopy forest that we do have in New England, we don't have the diversity of landscape. We don't have the mosaic of successional stages. You know, and those that diversity of landscapes would support you know, greater diversity of plants, greater diversity of animals, greater diversity of, you know, insects and and butterflies.
Yeah. So to dive in a little bit further about what we have right now, at least in our region in Connecticut, it's, you know, highly developed suburbia, generally speaking, right? So what you have is lots of highly maintained land that's maintained with the primary goal of cleanliness, which is shortly mown grass. Maybe they call it the wood lawn, right? So there's a lawn, and maybe there's a tree or two in the lawn, and that's the primary maintained landscape. And then what you have between properties, in many cases, is a small strip of wild land. So you have like a row of messy trees, messy looking trees with some bushes in there, usually something invasive, quote unquote. So you have basically neatly maintained lawn, and then this woods edge that is, you know, infinitesimally small, which you know, so basically you have a lot of woods edge. And then you also have a lot of, as you discussed, the open forest, the dense forest, I should say, the 100% canopy cover forest, which is what we were talking about with the leave no trace, with the laissez-faire, do not touch sort of forest. But then there's a lot of in between that had been here for thousands of years. There's the meadow, there's the old field, there's the open woodland, and that entire spectrum is underrepresented, generally speaking.
Yeah.
Vastly underrepresented. And these are the landscapes that we can begin to cultivate with the food forests, right?
Yeah. And we can tap into the the models that existed here thousands of years ago, where patches of land were cleared, you know, opened clearings, and then often initially corn, beans, and squash were planted.
Mm-hmm.
And then in there, small trees were planted that became shrubs, that became larger trees, and transitioned back into the larger forest once again. The entire ecosystem would cycle like that. And then when we compare that to the colonial times, patches of land were cut down, except after corn was grown, then wheat was grown, rye was grown, and then it was seeded as pasture, and then cows were grazed, and it never, I mean, up until the point that New England no longer became farmland, but it wasn't part of the cycle itself. It wasn't part of the agricultural cycle to, you know, fully close that loop on the cycle of the ecosystem as a whole.
Right, and so grazing cattle great cows. Like that in it of itself can be, through innovative practices like rotational grazing, can be an earth healing exercise. But I think what we found in the past, before rotational grazing, because it is more work, and it wasn't even really possible without the electric fencing, at least it was a lot more of a pain in the butt, because you would need to install, you know, 10 times more fence, because, and that's just 10 times more work. So, but without rotational grazing, then the cows will degrade the land over time. Mm-hmm. So that's why you had a field on your property, Brett, and that field grew this young forest that had a bunch of autumn olives, say. Mm-hmm. It was nitrogen poor. It was mm-hmm. like if cows are, you know, consistently fertilizing the land, if they're doing so in a way that in a particular way, that land is continually growing and being fertilized and, you know, becoming more abundant. But with the practices that were employed for at least 100 years in the landscape, because the land was overgrazed, the land got compacted, the nitrogen just ran off, and the earth never had a chance to heal after these grazing, the stomping, the you know, the manure.
And then the cows avoided plants. They avoided the thorny plants. So then the barberry grew more densely and other thorny plants grew more densely because the cows would graze around them. And
yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it created this damaged ecosystem. It's not necessarily the case that, you know, transitioning from corn into grazing is bad, because that can become like this self-sustaining ecosystem, but the way it was done definitely degraded the land.
The relationships weren't healthy for the land.
The relationships.
And the legacy of those relationships are what we've inherited.
Yeah.
The lack of balance, the lack of literacy of the landscape, the lack of relationship. We're out of relationship.
Yeah. And that's what that represents. That's what that degraded land represents. Being out of relationship. So I'd like to talk more about the experience of the forest garden and perhaps how that has shifted over time and perhaps how you could imagine it could be different in different contexts.
Sure. I mean, the interesting thing about it is that it's very much exists in, like, in real time. It exists, like, it's always evolving. And so every time I go back to it, it always is slightly different than before. Like, it's a very four-dimensional space.
Hmm.
And that is the three dimensions, obviously, of the spatial relations, but it really exists across time as well. And in particularly across the seasons.
Oh.
I like to liken it. Somebody mentioned something once about it. It really is like an orchestra, where you have, you know, at all the different points in the year, you have one plant or one specific thing that really comes into its own at a single moment, and that the garden seems to celebrate that one aspect of it, whether it's the flowering of the plums or the flowering of the peaches, which might happen, you know, a week apart, or it's the first fruits or the second fruits, you know, the honey berries or the mulberries, or you get to plum season, and it's as if they're it's as if there's like these tiny little holidays that are like a day or two or a week long for each plant that you celebrate, which is just a totally different way of interacting with food than, you know, having one big harvest at the end of the year, storing it in a silo or a granary and slowly eating it until you run out and hope you make it till the next harvest season, when the entire, you know, the entire year, you know, it's just one continuous celebration after the next of a small transient seasonal fruit or nut or berry, which, you know, has certain potentially really beneficial dietary implications as well, that I don't think have really ever been studied, but the potential health benefits in eating that way as well. I'm not sure if I answered your question at all.
You did. And I'm curious, do you want to go into the dietary and how you think that might be able to help people's diets and nutrition?
Well, I think, you know, something that was, this is big picture, but something that was lost since, say, the agricultural revolution, beginning of it, was that despite greater calorie density in the diet, there was a decrease in nutritional diversity. So the wide diversity of bionutrients, you know, phytochemicals that were previously consumed. You know, when you go back to like a couple million years ago, the ancestors of humans were eating thousands of different species of plants. And just imagining all the, you know, diverse phytochemicals in those, you know, fruits and nuts and tubers and berries compared to the 12 main vegetables and foods in general that we eat today. And when you look at, I believe it's like 60% of the world's calories come from two or three plants, from like corn and wheat.
Wow.
And so just that so narrow degree of nutritional diversity and the health implications for humans of that, and then also the health implications for the environment when we've replaced, you know, just enormous swaths of the of you know, previously diverse habitat with one or two or three crops. It just makes the entire system so fragile. And yeah, fragile for, you know, human health as well.
Yeah. Now, were these some of the topics that you wrote about in your book?
I'm working on writing it. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Still chugging along with that.
I see. So you'll keep me updated, and for all the listeners updated for when that book. Now, I got the pleasure and the privilege of reading an advanced copy, and I just want to throw the shout out there that this is a beautiful book that blends these ideas that have a foundation in deep truths along with a poetic nature that is, you don't see very often in a book. And so if you're interested in these large scale societal trends in their relationship and with food, with the human psyche and nutrition, I would highly recommend keeping abreast of Dr. Brett Lenner's work in this book.
Thank you, that was a very kind plug.
So we talked about the nutrition for both people and the earth, So you were talking about the symphony, mm-hmm. and of the forest garden, and I'm curious if you think that, is that a fundamental trait of a forest garden? Would that be consistent among all forest gardens? And how might that change between gardens?
You know, it was an intention of the design that I put in place. I think to some degree it is a trait of all forest gardens, at least relative to other gardens, even, you know, very productive orchards where, you know, it's all apples. It might be all one variety of apple, but they're all ripening within a 2 to 3 week window in the fall. But it was an intentional part of the design to pick fruits, you know, which, you know, you take the honey berry, it fruits in June. You know, how many crops do you get in June? Not many, and not many fruit crops either. And then when you go from honey berries, you're looking at like strawberries, June berries, mulberries, peaches, plums, pawpaws. You know, you're working your way through the summer to the fall. Apples, pears, and then when you look at persimmons, they'll hang on the tree all the way. A ripe persimmon will hang on the tree through December, depending on the tree. So there you have between between June and December. You know, you can just go out into your garden and pick a ripe fruit off a tree.
Wow.
You don't even have to, you don't have to can it, preserve it, store it, all these things. It's just there. Hmm. It's just there.
And the fact that you don't have to can it or preserve it feels important because there's that direct relationship is still available.
The direct relationship is available. It's less work.
Yeah.
It's less work. And then it's available to all the other animals too.
Hmm.
So they're all also benefiting to some degree.
Yeah.
And if you were a hunter, which at this point in my life I'm not, but you know, creating ecosystems like this would really foster, you know, wild populations of, you know,
yeah,
deer and bear and other animals that, hmm, you know, people used to, you know, feed from in relation to their support of the landscape as a whole. They would really just foster these populations.
Yeah, I can imagine that. And I think that what that makes me curious about is the what if aspect. Because, you know, if you had, you're seeing deer at your spot, your half acre of food forest, and you're seeing owls and the fox and everything. In just the half acre, I'm just imagining across scale, whether it's a lot of people doing a half acre, or whether it's a large swath of a forest that's maintained in this manner. What would be the implications, do you think, to people, to wildlife, and all of that, if we really scaled this up? And also, yeah, also maybe, like, what would it take to do that?
Hmm. That's a great question. You know, there actually have been some studies reflecting on pre-colonial forests during indigenous times, when the forests were managed with things like, you know, prescribed fires, which, you know, had the effect of supporting grass that's grown in the trees, more wider spacing of the trees. It would trend the forest towards more of a forest garden manner. And in the studies, the estimates that they put out was that there would be 20 to 30% more, like of wildlife in general, supported by those managed, semi-managed, human integrated ecosystems versus our laissez-faire, closed canopy forest that we have today.
Simply through prescribed burns.
It was actually just mentioning prescribed burns.
Oh.
And the effects that they have. So what do? So they increase the spacing of the trees because some trees have thicker bark and they can withstand the fires, and other trees have thinner bark and they can't. So then any single given tree within a wider space ecosystem produces more. It produces to its full potential, in the same way that if you're growing tomatoes in your garden and you plant them all too close to each other, none of them are really going to produce a lot of tomatoes.
Mm.
They need a certain amount of spacing for each individual plant to fully express itself. And when you do that at scale, as well as providing the nutrients that come from the ash, like calcium and other minerals, then that's fertilizer for the tree as well. So that's contributing to its productivity as well, and those benefits combined support just healthier animal populations in general.
So the prescribed burns, for a couple of different reasons, to help support healthier animal populations.
Yeah.
And so that's a study that proves that management can help. But what we're talking about seems like it's something beyond just clearing space between trees. And it's something that's even more intentional and perhaps could provide even more good.
Yeah. And the argument that I would make is that is also what was being employed in pre-Columbian times too. That indigenous people were trading seeds, you know, up trade routes and planting pawpaws where they're now found in little pockets in upstate New York, planting shellbark hickories where they're now found in small pockets, which can't be explained by animal dispersal of seeds, things like that. So there's evidence that indigenous people were growing forest gardens, and that just were not recognized by the colonial mind frame of what agriculture to them was. They weren't able to see just the really dynamic ecological interactions that were occurring.
And subtle.
And subtle, yeah, extremely subtle.
Yeah. To an extent, it makes so much sense that it just seems logical that with, especially with the Native Americans, like the idea about their culture was very much a land-based culture. And so I think it's a fair assumption to be made that they were in tune with the land to a greater degree than the average person is today. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like for them to bury a couple of hickory seeds that have bigger nuts than others would just make sense. It's almost like, well, why wouldn't they have done that if they were clearing the land and then they were, you know, they were growing a forest from there? Why wouldn't they just poke a nut in the ground or several nuts in the ground?
Yeah, there's such a in no other way to say this, like a racist ideology that it somehow they weren't capable of that or something like that when they were able to breed corn from Tio Sente. You know, they were able to do these amazing agricultural feats. You know, they you know, bred avocados in Mexico. And then, you know, there's evidence that they were breeding honey locusts in like the southeastern US. So just the concept that you know, that I think there's some just like lingering lack of appreciation for what existed here, that really, you know, deserves a better light to be brought to it. Mm-hmm. And along those lines too, in terms of the future of where the land conservation in the United States ought to go, you know, there's some really good models now of indigenous land trusts that are starting to do really like amazing work. Things like Segura Te in the Bay Area in Southern California, led by Karina Gold out there, Danielle Hill of the Wampanoag on Cape Cod, starting to manage some land there. And so in terms of, you know, coming back to that idea of relationship once again, opening dialogue for the human relationships to come back into balance with the ecological relationships, with the economic relationships, with the relationships between animals. There is an overall integration and kind of pattern language to the health that that really can tie itself all together if we allow the space for it to come into being, if we open dialogues and allow for all these aspects to come back into relation with one another. You know, that would be the real vision for, you know, the next step of you know, where we go as an American culture. That's like the next step of the American dream. That's the real American Revolution, right? The one that we haven't quite had yet. Like the Langston Hughes poem, we're living in the land that never has been yet. You know, that's the country that never has been yet. You know, that we have these ideals or things and we just really haven't, they've never come to fruition, at least in colonial times. But that's so fully capable of here. And once you start to interact with the land in a certain way, you just realize how much it can resonate. And how much it wants to be born, you know. It's like really just asking for the opportunity to come into existence.
Great. Yeah. So I feel inspired. the next question is to concretize it a bit and to bring it into the here and now. And so for anybody listening who feels also as inspired as I do right now, but they want to do something. They want to do something right now. What do you think that, I know it'll be different from context to context, but is there any principles that they can apply or even actual things that they can do?
I would say that it really does begin with the land around you and building relationships with for me at least with the plants. I think plants are a nice place to start. So it's observing, you know, it's like going down the road and seeing, hey, there's this old apple tree down the road and I've never maybe tasted the apples from it. So you grab an apple off that tree, and if you like it, then you take a seed from it and you put it in a little damp paper towel in your fridge for a couple weeks and you let it sprout, and then you start that tree. Or it's finding a local patch of wild blueberries and, you know, maybe they're being overgrown by vines because nobody is really paying any attention to that land at all. And you clear back the vines so that those wild blueberries can grow. And then you start some of those seeds, you bring them to your backyard and you plant them next to your blueberries that you have. You let them cross-pollinate, you start those seeds. It's just a really creative, exploratory process. And then you connect with your neighbors, you share plants. And
So it sounds like the principle there would be, first, find what's around you right now.
Mm.
And then start to build that relationship. And it starts as simple as eating the berries.
Eating the berries. Know? It starts with the harvest. It's often the most joyous part.
Yeah. And then from there, you can begin to work your way up in terms of seeding, this cross-pollinating. And it doesn't have to be complicated, but you have to just begin.
Yeah, just begin. And that was, I would say, and, you know, obviously there's so many ways to enter into a relationship with the world and with people around you, and that was maybe just the way that worked for me. But there's really countless ways. You know, mm-hmm. maybe some people really enjoy talking to people, maybe more than I do. And they want to start that way, by connecting with people who have similar, you know, ideas, and they want to learn more and just have those conversations.
Yeah. So to an extent, it's for the individual, it's understanding yourself and how do you best learn, whether it's hands-on approach, whether it's books, whether it's talking to people, whether it's something in between hands-on. The way I like is to deeply observe ecologies and plants, and I look at a meadow and I'll take account of all the different patches of plants, and I'll be curious about, why is this plant here, why is that plant there? Oh, it's the landscape shape. Oh, it's the relative amount of sun. Oh, it's the aspect, east facing, north facing, whatever. And that helps to bring me into relation, and then it informs my design in the future, because I get to see these plants' tendencies in my climate.
Yeah, I think that's so huge, that curiosity.
Curiosity.
The curiosity, and then over time it lends itself towards the literacy, towards the... And we're all students, right? You're still a student, I'm still a student. Every year I learn more about each plant that I interact with, and I don't know that I'll ever learn, you know, close to, you know, what was once known here about all these plants. And and then also all the cultural symbolism that can be laid on them, you know, understanding the white pine tree, you know, not just because you can make, you know, vitamin-rich tea from it, but understanding its symbolism as a tree of peace, as, you know, pine groves as burial grounds, you know, really embodying the gentleness of the boughs with the, you know, what it means to, you know, bury loved ones in the ground. There's so many depths, layers of depth that of relationship that we could potentially move towards that we haven't even scratched the surface of yet.
Yeah. And as you begin to dive into that, those relationships, as you just simply begin, you'll start to uncover step by step some of those layers. So it's about curiosity, just being open, but beginning, making a practice of it, just as though there are people who make a practice of going to the gym. You know, you gotta build that habit. Maybe you have, if you are interested in regimens, say, you could say, you know, 30 minutes a week, you know, every Friday after work, I'm gonna go for a hike. And my intention for the hike is to really tune in. You know, maybe you'll set certain boundaries, like, I'm not going to speak about anything except what I'm seeing around me. And as such, you're going to stay in that present moment, and you're going to observe every animal that crosses your path. You're going to notice even how the wind feels on your body if it's breezy, or how the pitter-patter of rain is falling from the trees, and all that. That would be a good place to begin. But I also would be remiss to not mention the value of mentors. Now, I'm not pitching a mentor here, you know, but at the same time, a lot of the growth that I've experienced as a human, whether it's professionally or maybe in sports, or, you know, growth takes on a next level if you can find somebody who's been there and done that and has the experience, because there's so much that you can't learn from a book, and you have to learn through experience. But if you have somebody around there who's already experienced it, then they can help to tune you in to the experiences that are proportionate to your next step. And so they'll help your growth.
100%.
Okay, well, this feels like a comfortable point to wrap it up. Brett, I really appreciate your time for this talk.
Likewise. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I always appreciate the conversation and the friendship.
As do I, my friend.
It's happy that we get to share it with potentially others who are interested in listening today.
So. Amazing. Is there anything else that we haven't quite touched on that is on your mind?
We did cover a lot of territory today. Maybe for a future episode.
There you go.
Leave it for you.
And then if anybody wants to contact you for any reason at all, A, would you be open to that? And then B, if so, where would they find you? Is it social media or email, or what would you?
Yes, you're welcome to contact me. We could provide an email link.
Sounds good.
And then I am on Instagram as well.
Uh-huh.
First and last name, the number 7. So Brett Leonard 7. I'm working on putting up more Forest Garden related content on there.
Yeah, I do appreciate your content. I there's a lot of good nature context. Got a lot of good nature perspective that you get to see. Yeah, so thanks for that. Okay, well, again, thanks a lot for a great show, and we'll talk again soon.
And there you have it. That was Dr. Brett Leonard talking about his personal food forest in his backyard of the home that he grew up in. Now, this is a story of dedication, and it's a story of healing. I hope that you received a lot of value from this conversation. And if you did, feel free to give us a good rating on the Apple Podcasts and share with your friends. Thanks a lot. So long.